From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the latest edition of Mother Jones Magazine, the writer and journalist Charles Bowden offers a stark and honest portrayal of the industry of illegal immigration along the country's southern border. For Bowden, who lives just 60 miles from the border and has spent his life extracting stories from the region, this is personal. Bowden understands the studies that prove illegal immigration hurts the United States or benefits the United States. He knows people are proposing solutions, trying to figure out the complex supply and demand which feeds the story. But in the end, Bowden has concluded you don't get to pick solutions. You simply have choices, he writes, and by these choices, you will discover who you really are. Today in the program, Charles Bowden will join us to talk about the 7,000 miles he traveled to witness a journey of biblical proportions. The article is called Exodus. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. At Liberty Park last night, about 100 people showed up for a rally about immigration reform. That's just one of the events connected to President George Bush's visit to the state. 100 is respectable, but the rally got the least amount of attention of the Bush-related rallies and didn't compare to the thousands who gathered to make a statement about immigration earlier this year. Utahns apparently are distracted by, among other things, the war in Iraq. But in his article in the latest edition of Mother Jones Magazine, the writer and journalist Charles Bowden notes that when the dust settles, the stream of migrants flowing into the United States from the southern border will influence the country more than the Iraq War. The war, Bowden writes, is who we are. The migrants are who we will be. Today in the program, Charles Bowden is joining us to talk about his story, which took him more than 7,000 miles to witness a journey of biblical proportions. His article is called Exodus. We invite you to join us if you like. 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Charles Bowden is the author of 21 books, among them Blood Orchid, Juarez, Shadow in the City, his most recent Inferno. His work regularly appears in the magazines Harper's, GQ, and other publications. His article Exodus, Coyotes, Pollos, and The Promised Van is in the current edition of Mother Jones Magazine, as we mentioned. And Charles Bowden is joining us today from his home in Tucson, Arizona. Charles Bowden, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Well, I'm glad to be back. Thank you.
I wanted to ask about the way you begin the piece, because it's a really kind of broad, sort of sweeping way that you begin it. You refer to the changing nature of the world, about global warming and viruses and pollution and nuclear weapons and war. And I'm wondering, is this really kind of the bigger context for this story?
Well, I think so. That's why I wrote it that way. Yeah. I mean, a lot of these people coming north are what you'd call climate refugees from ravaged districts. I interviewed people on the border from Central America who were leaving their homeland because their homes had been destroyed by hurricanes, for example. I interviewed Mexican Indians from the south that said the rain doesn't come anymore. So that's part of it. I mean, this dislocation is global, these migrations. Here's the trick for Americans to understand. This is the place where what's happening all over the world slaps us in the face, because we're the only first world nation on Earth sharing a giant border with a third world nation, Mexico. Mm. So reality knocks on our lives and says hello with the Mexican migration.
In the end, you write that we don't get to pick solutions in the issue of immigration. You simply have choices. And by these choices, you explain, we will discover who we really are. What do you mean by that?
Well, look at We're a nation of immigrants. We profess to believe, you know, we're a welcome wagon for anyone. That's simply not true, you know. Since 1924, we've had restricted immigration. The other thing is, it is no longer 1910. There's 300 million people in this country. Yeah. The place is getting full. But we don't like to face that. We, as the president says, we're a welcoming people. Well, if we're a welcoming people, why do we have thousands of people guarding our borders, for example?
Yeah.
The other thing is the people against immigration like to say these Mexicans should do this legally. Well, there is no way to do it legally. If you're a 20-year-old Mexican and, you know, a poor person, and you file to legally immigrate to the United States, you better count on living to be 100. before your part of the quota will come up. So what you have is a bunch of poor people escaping doom, violating our laws, and entering our country in numbers far greater than the U.S. government will acknowledge. And as long as I'm on this rant, these bills in Congress are preposterous. We'll have worker permits. There's over 12 million illegal people in this country now. How many permits are you going to print? They're talking about 200,000, 300,000, 400,000. They're not acknowledging the magnitude of what we're dealing with. I believe, frankly, I'll bet my life, over a million Mexicans are entering this country illegally every year, just for openers. So worker permits is just something to say on the floor of Congress. You know, I've lived in this country a long time, and of course, like any good American, I've always envied the drugs Congress must have access to say these things. But the McCain-Kennedy bill, in my opinion, doesn't address reality any more than the bills in the House that are going to criminalize illegal immigration and build big walls address reality.
You know,
I'm the only reality, apparently.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that it seems like that kind of the indelible lesson that I sort of took from the article is that, you know, there really aren't any answers, really aren't any solutions, only a way of looking, as you say, at this reality and looking at it either with compassion or in some ways with ambivalence, it seems.
Well, I have spent 30 years with two absolutely consistent ideas in my head. One is there should only be 100 million people in this country, and I want to go back to the Pleistocene. And the second is, for 30 years, I've helped Mexicans illegally enter the country because I'm incapable of telling a poor person they can't make a living. And so I'm a walking contradiction, as are most of the people in this country. We're building walls on the border, and yet everybody that comes to visit me, if I take them to see one of these walls, shudders because it looks like Nazi Germany, with the barbed wire, the big steel wall, the towers with lights. And they don't want that to be part of who they are, but that's who we're becoming. You got to face the fact that nobody will talk about population, nobody will talk about resources, but there's 6 billion people on Earth. They say there's going to be 10 billion, and then the populations are growing, and the amount of the resources are declining. Eventually, push comes to shove. And in the case of Mexico, push has come to shove. 15% of the Mexican population now, at least, is living inside the United States illegally. They're fleeing their own country because they can't survive. You know, that's the reality you have to talk about. And while I might as well be giving a sermon. This thing started exploding as soon as the North American Free Trade Agreement passed. It destroyed Mexican agriculture, peasant agriculture, because, frankly, Archer Midland and these companies can produce corn at half the price of a Mexican campesino. So NAFTA unleashed a new multitude coming north simply because they were starving.
Well, you know, it's interesting that a big part of this story is a kind of personal observation or reflection for you of kind of the old Latin world. I mean, you write about this old Indian man, for example. He used to raise crops in the desert in a traditional way, the Ak-Chin.
Yes. Yeah, that was basically dry land farming, living off the rainfall, which has vanished. And 30 years ago, my first book was about people like that.
Yeah.
Back in the 70s, you know, before the world began, when I knew Paul Revere and all that. And I'd go out there and stay with him. And what I remember is not only this dying way of life, living within the budget of resource flows, meaning annual rainfall, but also I would run into Mexicans then who were illegally wandering the desert trying to get farm work further north, and I'd just give them a ride, driving 50 or 100 miles. I did that today. Chances are good. I'd be pulled over by the Border Patrol. I'd go to jail. I'd probably pay a $25,000 fine, and I'd have to hire a lawyer that, you know, would want more money than God. And so now I'm paralyzed, and everyone I know who's lived on the border is. In a way, you want to do the right thing. On the other hand, you don't want to go to jail. And, you know, these people are downtrodden. Like three times in the last 3 months, I have picked up Mexicans in the desert who just wanted me to turn them into the Border Patrol because they've been crushed by simply trying to walk across the desert. There's a that's what I mean. You get to find out who you are.
Yeah.
And look at it. Isn't nice. Look at it. If you're honest, look at your listeners know that very few of our ancestors arrived here on yachts. They were the garbage of Europe and Asia, the people nobody wanted. That's who built this country. So when you meet some poor devil out in the desert who's just trying to sneak into the country like our ancestors, meaning just to better themselves, you see a kind of mirror. You see your own people, in a sense. Now, I realize before somebody calls into the show, they'll say, well, my ancestors entered legally. Well, frankly, in 1880, unless you're croaking from tuberculosis, there was no barrier. All you had to do was ride a crummy ship, land at Ellis Island, and they gave you a walking paper.
Yeah.
There were no quotas. There were no restrictions except disease and a history of criminality, you know. And basically, I know the standards were low because I know the people I came from, they couldn't jump over big hurdles.
You know, it's interesting. You seem to have come to this message early in your life. You tell this story with your father, that a night you spent on a street in Durango, Mexico.
Yeah, well, you know, I was the typical middle-class kid.
Yeah.
Part of this country is you better yourself so your children never know what your experiences were.
Yeah.
My father and mother came from extreme poverty, rural poverty. Finally wound up in Chicago, made a living, prospered. Basic American story. I'm down in Mexico. It's 1960. The old man's bought an old bread van, thrown a bunk in there, a Coleman stove, and about 10 cases of beer. We're parked on a street in Durango, which is the capital of the state of Durango. And everybody's poor, and he's cooking a chicken he'd gotten out of a can. My father was not quite a three-star chef. And all these little urchins start showing up, and they look terribly hungry. And the old man just starts handing out all the food in the truck. He guts our entire pantry. And I ask him, why did you do that? And he just looks at me with, I think, a kind of disgust and sadness.
Yeah.
And doesn't say anything. And, of course, years later, I knew what he was doing, meaning I was in the same place, I mean, the same experience. But he knew what real poverty was. He'd gone to bed a lot of nights in his life hungry, and he just did the immediate human impulse. These people need food. And I must say, my father was a rock-ribbed conservative Republican. But none of that matters when you collide with these things. None of it matters when you're out in this desert and somebody's staggering after 3 days of 100-degree heat and needs help. You forget about immigration laws and everything else. You just help them.
At what point, Charles, did you strike upon the image of this, you know, this stream of humanity as, what did you come upon it in biblical terms, the idea of it being an exodus?
Well, that's pretty easy. One, I became angry for the last couple of years, and since I'm a sweet guy, this is unusual, that everybody was lying about the magnitude of the migration. I'm down dealing with a town nobody listening to this program has ever heard of, Sasebe, Sonora, which at that time had 1,200 people, and they're moving 1,000 to 4,000 people a day through the wire. Meanwhile, my government's talking about 200,000 or 300,000 illegals a year, and I got one town moving more than that. Secondly, I talked to these Mexicans, and they weren't going home. Look at, when you're out there and you run into a guy who's 28 years old, and it's June, and it's 110 degrees, and he's going to walk that night 30 miles with a month-old baby, you know you're dealing with people with no options. They're not coming north to pick tomatoes or something. The third thing is, my wake-up call was 4 years ago. I picked up the paper. They'd found an 18-year-old woman dead in the desert with a month-old baby still alive on her breast. This was in the summer.
Yeah.
Well, people like that aren't moving if they have a choice. Do you follow?
Yeah.
They're not coming up because, oh, my heavens, I heard I can make a few bucks this summer somewhere. They're fleeing something. And, of course, since God looks out for writers, I go down to the center of illegal immigration, Altar, Sonora, which moves, according to the former mayor, he thinks 800,000 people a year alone. And there's a flop house there for these migrants before they, you know, meet the coyote, and it's called Exodus. So I thought, well, this is ordained. I'll take them at their word.
Charles, I want to have you read something before we go to break. This is from page 40.
At
the moment it begins.
Somewhere, you mean?
At the moment, though, you're penniless.
Oh, okay. At the moment, though, you're penniless, unemployed, and frightened. You're worth a few hundred dollars, almost like an oil future. But you must get to that stash house in America before you're worth real money and worth protecting. And you will do it by force of will. In this sector of the line, the 262-mile-long Tucson sector, a few hundred will officially die each year. Others will die and rot in the desert and go uncounted. A year ago, a woman from Zacatecas disappeared in late June. Her father came up and searched for weeks to find her body in the desert, a valley of several hundred square miles. He stumbled on three other corpses before finding the remains of his own child. At dusk, you'll go through the line with 20, 30 or more Mexicans. There will be a guide. You will carry a gallon of water and a black day pack. The temperature in summer could be 115 degrees. You will walk anywhere from 10 to 60 miles, depending on the route and what you have agreed to pay. There will be rattlesnakes, cactus, trees, and almost no sign of people. Everything will have thorns that rake your skin as you stumble through the darkness. You will keep up, or you will be left behind. If you are a woman, you have a fair chance of being raped. And you will most likely never speak of these nights again as long as you live. You will have children and grandchildren. You will teach them many things. But if you are like the others who have passed this way, these nights will remain your secret.
Charles Bowden is with us. His article, Exodus, Coyotes, Pollos, and the Promised Van, appears in the current edition of Mother Jones Magazine. We invite you to join us at 585 West, 585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I'm going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on FM 90. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're joined by the writer and journalist Charles Bowden, talking about his article on immigration in the latest edition of Mother Jones Magazine. Bowden traveled some 7,000 miles documenting the experience of the thousands of immigrants who make their way across the southern border of the United States. It's a dark portrait, but also honest and humane. Like global warming, Bowden writes, illegal immigration has now become a force beyond the reach of American power and will and imagination. Bowden calls his piece Exodus. We invite you to join us if you like. 585 West is the number, 585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Charles Bowden, I wanted to ask you about Altar. In the article, you say that this region, this place, there are two things that happen to a visitor. And one of them is a person tries to find something to make sense, some metaphor to sort of wrap around the town. What do you mean by that?
Well, what they're looking at is one of the key points in the largest human migration that's occurring on the surface of the earth. And it's very unfamiliar. It's a community of 18,000 people, 60 miles by dirt road south of the American line. It's totally isolated, yet it's processing 600,000 to 800,000 Mexicans a year that are going through. The entire community is nothing but coyotes and flop houses for migrants and guys that drive vans. And so, yeah, you try and, like, I have a friend, Phil Caputo, who's a novelist, wrote a great Vietnam memoir, Rumor of War, and he thought it looked like a giant Walmart for illegals. You just try and hang on to something. Because if you've been reading the papers here and listening to the politicians, you don't understand the magnitude of this migration. When you walk into the plaza at Altar, you do. It's like a beehive of people going north. The other thing your listeners wouldn't know, I mean, why would they? Sonorans are more European in appearance than most Mexicans, and they're a lot taller. They're big people. Yeah. But when you get to Altar, everybody's short and dark. They're Indians from the south. So you can look around, you know, none of these people are from here, but they've all gotten off the bus. Then you sit in the plaza by the church, and bus after bus just arrives all day long, and people get off looking bewildered. They've never even been in a desert before. They've been raised down in some place where bananas hang on trees, and they start making negotiations to go north. a guy will come up to you and start talking to you, and he'll say, do you know where Tennessee is? Or do you know where Oregon is? Or do you know where North Carolina is? Because that's all they've got, is a phone number and a name of some relative that they're going to, and they have no idea where it is. They've never been outside their village.
Did you notice that, because I certainly did in the way you wrote this piece, that at this point in the script, as you talk about, that as the coyotes are eyeing you over, that these people stop being human, you know, man or child. They become, for example, they become chickens, literally. They call them pollos at this point. Right.
You're just a commodity.
Yeah.
Look at it. The thing to remember is when you're sitting in that bus seat riding for days to get north, that's the last time you have any control, that you have any private space. You're going to get off that bus. You're going to meet a coyote. And at least 90 to 95% of these people employ a coyote, because otherwise you're going to get caught. The coyote will then stash you in one of these flop houses, and you're stacked up like sardines in there on just boards. Mm. And they store you until they get a big enough number to move you. You might be there a day or 2 days, and then suddenly they'll say, let's go. And you're stuffed into a van. You take a van, such as people see on the streets in Salt Lake, you take out all those seats. You just put iron bars there. You put 40 people in there, just cram them in like sardines. And you drive 60 miles of bad dirt road to the line, and you get out, and then the adventure starts. Toward late afternoon, you go through that wire, and you've got to make it to the van. The next van, that's going to be probably 30 to 60 miles away. And when you get to that van, you're taken to a stash house in Tucson. Mm. When you get to the stash house in Tucson, the big guy shows up, and he asks for those phone numbers you've been carrying. You hand it to him. He makes a call. He says, I want $1,500 or $2,000 to deliver this person. When the person on the other end says yes, then you get to be slightly human again. Now you're worth money. Because the way this works is the Mexicans that are here illegally, that have jobs, they guarantee for their kinfolk. Do you follow? If you will bring my cousin to me, or my wife, or my uncle, I will give you that in cash. So then you're valuable. If you can follow my logic.
Yeah.
Once they've guaranteed it, you're no longer a poor Mexican nobody gives a damn about. You're a $2,000. You're $1,500. Then they'll start taking care of you. But from getting off that bus in Altar until you get to Tucson, you're worth a couple $100. And some make it, some don't. They'll stop when you're crossing the desert in the night. They'll let you rest. And if you're a weak person that's been lagging behind, they won't wake you up. They'll just leave you because they can't have the group slowed down. It's a hazardous crossing. Now, a long time ago in the early 80s, because I didn't think anybody was dealing with the reality then, I went to Sonora, hooked up with a bunch of Mexicans, walked 45 miles a night in one night with them across the desert in June.
Wow.
Which is one of the reasons the experience, what it feels like, is not an abstraction to me. Yeah. At that time, I was running marathons, lifting weights, you know, drinking bottled water and eating carrots, you know. I was in terrific shape, and it damn near killed me. When I got out, I remember, and I'd had a deal that I'd call when I got out, so those three and a half people on Earth who cared whether I lived or died would know, and I'm at this payphone, and I kept dialing, and I kept getting getting numbers in Europe. My mind was so far gone from all that heat that I couldn't make any sense. So I walked into a saloon run by a Basque and laid on the floor, and he just kept bringing me water and beer. And it took 6 hours before I could even urinate.
Wow.
Now, look, what your listeners have to remember is I was a citizen. I could walk in and do that. The Mexicans I were with, they had to just keep going. Do you follow?
Yeah.
They were still being hunted. But I had the easy part of the journey. Their journey remained hard until they got to their destination.
Charles, I wonder about what's so sort of intriguing about the piece is the, I have to say, the kind of brutal honesty And there are elements of it that aren't what you would construe as, you know, necessarily politically correct. And I wondered if you had to kind of battle these sort of cultural stereotypes and impressions and knee-jerk reactions among, for example, your editors and people you talked about. Because there's a kind of clarity that seems shocking. I mean, it disturbs, I think, you know, sensibilities.
I can answer that. One, you know, obviously Mother Jones printed it,
yeah,
so I have no quarrel. But there was a period of, you say what?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And look, I don't blame them. I'm an American, you know. I believe instinctively if you state a problem, I'm supposed to think of a solution.
Yeah.
You know, let's put on a musical. But I was raised, you know, that your glass is always half full. It's not half empty. You know, don't complain. We can fix this. And so, yeah, there was a resistance to what I was saying. The other thing is, people will come down here, and I've become like a tour guide the last couple of years for other reporters, and they'll say, what's the solution, once they finally realize the enormity of it? And I'll tell them what I believe is the truth, that they are looking at it. The solution is, if Mexico doesn't export these people, it'll explode. Yeah. We'll have a revolution down there, which isn't going to be pleasant for us. And if the United States actually acknowledges the magnitude of the migration, they'll have a domestic explosion here among the voters. So here's the game. We hire guys that pretend to catch them, but almost everybody gets through. And then we claim that the migration's much lower than it is. Mexico talks about poor treatment of their illegals, and everything goes on as before. Now, if you take what these Mexicans are sending home, meaning the remittances, what they're sending home at a minimum every day is the equivalent of, let's say a barrel of oil is worth $70 today. It's the equivalent of half of the income off 500,000 barrels of oil a day. It is propping up Mexico. It's well over $20 billion a year now. Mexico makes far more from illegal immigrants sending money home than it does from selling oil. It's bigger, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, than it does from tourism.
Yeah.
It's second biggest industry. The other thing, which annoys people when I say it, but what the devil, that's my function in life, is if you take every progressive effort in this country to end poverty, none of them has ever been as successful as illegal immigration. That we now have at least 12 million illegal people in this country, and the instant they cross that wire, their income jumps tenfold. I don't know of any war on poverty we've ever had here with such astounding results. But the biggest, let's say, success story in erasing poverty in the history of this country has been illegal immigration, which is another reason they're not going to go home. They know it, too.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you about the Minutemen, because you spent some time with them in telling this story. And I have to say, it may be surprising to some when you confess that you liked them. In fact, you liked them a lot.
Yeah, well, look, they're decent people. I mean, they believe that illegal immigration is going to taint our country, meaning, you know, these people, them, those people,
yeah,
will destroy it. But look, what they're doing is legal. It's perfectly legal to defend and uphold the laws of the United States. They're not shooting anyone. The most they do is if they spot an illegal, they call the Border Patrol. They don't physically themselves try and retain them. The other thing that's kind of odd, especially with the older Minutemen, because there's two blocks. There's sort of the guys in their 30s playing John Wayne and eating Spam out of cans. Mm. And then there's these older guys in their 60s, 70s, and 80s who have raised families, you know, been to their wars and that. And what they're doing, besides, you know, doing these sort of surveillance patrols, is having this wonderful geriatric Woodstock every night out in the desert. And it's kind of pleasant. They're, you know, instead of playing shuffleboard at some Sun City, they're having a whale of a time being Minutemen. And so, yes, they're quite attractive, you know, to me, you know. But I think what your listeners should realize is they're guerrilla theater, that they have no consequence except the publicity they get on illegal immigration. When I was with them in April of this year, they were patrolling a line they'd made in the desert 2 miles long. Well, the border's 1,951 miles long. But, you know, a Mexican has about as much chance of being hit by a meteor entering the country illegally as colliding with a Minuteman. Just think of guys who have found a sort of fun way to go camping and sit around in lawn chairs with binoculars. You know, what's the harm? It's like the humanitarian groups, whom I personally know the people involved, that are putting water stations out in the desert.
Yeah.
Well, I hardly can fault somebody who's trying to help people from dying, you know, to prevent them from dying of thirst. But once again, the chances of a Mexican finding one of these water stations in the vastness of the desert is about the same as getting hit by a meteor. Both of these are just normal gestures. People don't like change. To suddenly have a million poor Mexicans pouring into the country a year is obviously going to create a reaction. You know, nobody should be surprised by that. Suddenly in Kentucky, there's these colonias sprouting up like mushrooms, North Carolina everywhere, Iowa. Well, of course, you know, people say, what's going on here? Every wave of migration we've ever had has produced this. There really were signs and Boston windows, no Irish need apply. I mean, every immigrant group's gone through this. Mm-hmm. This isn't new.
One of the most sort of enduring images, I think, for me in this story was La Santísima Muerte.
Oh, yes. Most Holy Death.
Yeah. Talk about that.
Well, to start with, your listeners should realize that think of the image you've seen of the Grim Reaper, only this time the Grim Reaper in one hand is holding the entire planet Earth. Now, Santa Muerte popped up about 3 years after NAFTA in a very poor crime-ridden barrio in Mexico City, and it's now spread throughout the country. It spreads so vastly throughout Mexico that the Archbishop or Bishop of Mexico has issued instructions on how you can cleanse yourself from this cult. And poor Mexicans and poor drug dealers worship her because they think she gives succor, that she can help them. And in Nuevo Laredo, which is right on the border in Texas,
yeah,
there's a shrine just on the edge of town with 7-foot statues of her. And you see poor people there all day just praying to her. She is kind of the result of the dislocation going on in Mexico. And what she promises is to protect you, you know, from death and from poverty.
I want to have you read this section, if you would.
Sure. In Nuevo Laredo, near the Rio Grande, a market stall sells statues of Christ, the Virgin of Guadalupe, Emiliano Zapata, and La Santísima Muerte, who outsells all the others combined. She touches more human behavior than the Border Patrol or Homeland Security or the DEA. She holds the whole world in her bony hand. For years, she succored the souls being displaced and hurled north, listened to their fears and hungers while politicians talked about slight adjustments in the global economy, while others spoke of guest worker programs, as some babbled about pathways to citizenship, as growing numbers rumbled about building big walls on the line, and still others explained the need for workers to perform tasks beneath the notice of native-born Americans. All this while, like the illegals themselves, she remained largely invisible to those who believed themselves to be in control. Most Holy Death is the real face of the migration, one kept safely off camera, one never invited to be on the cable talk shows, one worshipped by men and women who scorn presidents.
Charles Bowden is with us. His article in the new edition of Mother Jones is called Exodus, Coyotes, Pollos, and the Promised Van. We invite you to join us if you like. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on FM 90. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the latest edition of Mother Jones Magazine, the writer and journalist Charles Bowden offers a stark and honest portrayal of the industry of illegal immigration along the country's southern border. For Bowden, who lives just 60 miles from the border and has spent his life extracting stories from the region, this is a personal story. 585 West is the number to join the conversation, 585-9378. Charles Bowden is with us today talking about his article. And as we mentioned, we invite you to join us. I want to ask about the drug trade, Charles Bowden. I mean, you say there's a kind of fantasy that suggests that the drug trade and illegal immigration are somehow separate. It's not true.
It's a lie. Obviously, if you can move a kilo of cocaine, you can move a person and vice versa. The same networks move both. What's happened over the last decade is that moving people has become an incredibly big industry. The U.S. government estimates, you know, that it's a $10 billion a year industry in Mexico. Yeah. I'd say it's at least that. And so, yeah, this is the same guys do both. But I talked to a guy who's in the story who does both.
Yeah.
You know, he moves drugs and he moves people. As he told me, look, an illegal Mexican is just a kilo with legs. It's the perfect product. It can walk itself to market. The other oddity is, you know, if you're moving a truckload of cocaine and the U.S. agents capture it,
yeah,
they keep the cocaine. But if you're a coyote moving 30 Mexicans and the Border Patrol captures them, they drive them back to the border and give them back to you. And then you do it again. You follow?
Yeah.
It's a dream business. You know,
which pays better?
I think they're getting to parity.
Wow.
You know, there's obviously the drug industry is still larger, but as increased U.S. enforcement grows, every time you put another Border Patrol agent on the border, you're increasing the payday of coyotes because they raise the fees. Like, I think in January it was $1,200 in Sasebe. By April, it was 1,700, and now I'm sure it's well over 2,000 because the National Guard really ratcheted up the fees. What your listeners have to understand is that it doesn't matter what you have to pay a coyote, because in Mexico, you can make $5 or $10 a day at most if you're a poor Indian. But if I get you to Chicago and I put you in a back room and you wash dishes, you'll make 150. You can make 100 a day working. And so, you know, let's say they pay $5,000. A couple months, they've paid off their debt. They're in the United States making more money than they ever dreamed of. So it isn't going to stop them at all. But I was just in New Orleans 3 days ago, and it's filling with illegals doing the reconstruction. Now, the guys I talked to are sending home $800 to $2,000 a month. They're living in the abandoned houses, because they don't need housing. They come from such a hard background. They're making $150 a day, and they're working 6 days a week at least. They're not going to go away. I mean, you know, this is a dream. And you can hardly see them. They're invisible. Now, the Spanish language radio there has, like, codes in their broadcast telling the illegals where the Border Patrol is.
Yeah.
The employers hide them because they're precious. They need people to reconstruct the city. But nothing's going to stop this. The only thing that could stop, you know, technically illegal immigration, is just make, let's say we make a fine of $50,000 an hour to employ one. Well, then obviously nobody would employ them. But that isn't likely to happen. The restaurant industry, the construction industry, the hotel industry, all these industries have become addicted to cheap labor. The slaughterhouse industry. There's a big lobby for illegal immigration.
585 West is the number to join us, 585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Nancy sends this email. She writes, thanks to Charles Bowden for looking at the current immigration issue from a humanitarian point of view rather than a legal one. I hope his writing will be a catalyst, she writes, to soften and change the mind of Americans who view Mexican immigrants as criminals. These two opposing views of the poor and destitute remind me of the characters of Jean Valjean and Javert in Les Miserables. A poor man deemed a lifelong criminal for stealing bread so he may eat, and an inexplicable police officer, inflexible police officer, excuse me, determined to imprison him for his offense. Dan is joining us from Salt Lake now. Dan, welcome.
Welcome. Hi. I actually just have a comment. Thank you for doing this show. I think it's very important that we talk about it. My comment is more against, once again, how language is being used to, further demonize a population. So, I mean, I think the term illegal and the terminology further demonizes and complicates the situation that doesn't allow us to really look at other, to look beyond the issues, right?
So I think, look at I understand your point, but I don't agree, and I'll tell you why. Nobody's handing a coyote $2,000 because they're legal. I mean, these euphemisms, I think, also have to end. These people are entering the country illegally. They know it. That's why they're walking 30, 40 miles across a volcanic desert and risking their life. Otherwise, they just enter at the port of entry.
Well, they would be without documents, right?
Well, they can't get documents. That's,
exactly.
You know, if you want
so
to go the other
coming
side
in
of
without
the coin,
any type of
people
documentation.
Say, well, they should do this legally. Well, there is no way to do it legally. We have such a low quota for Mexicans coming up here. You know, they'd never get in, and they know it. But they're violating the law, and they know it. That's why they sneak around and pay coyotes.
Well, and then that's why we got to look at the bigger issue, right? Just because the law is there doesn't necessarily just mean that the law is right.
Well, look, if you smoke marijuana, you know you're breaking
the
law. You can say, I don't approve
of
the law.
Then I think we need to probably move away from language that further demonizes the being, right? Because you've talked about globalization. You talked about other exterior issues. Right.
Yeah, well, look, I'll address one thing there. There was an email, you know, that was read a moment ago about, you know, people seeing them as criminals. Well, look, some of them are criminals, but that number that's tossed about how many are criminals, almost all these people they say are criminals or people who have been, their crime was they violated the immigration law entering the country. You follow? But they have a record for getting picked up before entering illegally. I mean, these are just working people that are coming north. But it's just nonsense to think we got a bunch of professional criminals. Why would they be in New Orleans risking their lives? Every worker you talk to there that's illegal has what they call the Katrina cough from the mold. Why would they be working like dogs if they were, you know, like mafia members or something? These are just working people, just like our ancestors were.
Dan, we're glad you called. Thanks a lot. 585-WEST again is the number, 585-9378. Greg is with us in Salt Lake. Hi, Greg.
Hello. How you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Okay. Well, I just have a quick comment. I appreciate this program, and I totally agree with your guest there. The thing I wish that we could do in this country is just make it much easier to let Mexicans come in legally. You know, I mean, have a much, much, much higher quota, etc. I don't know, kind of an Ellis Island sort of thing or something that would allow them to come in en masse. Legally, but that's just my opinion. Thanks. I can take the answer off the air.
Thanks. Well, everyone wants that solution, don't they, Charles Post?
Yeah, well, they want a magic bullet, but here's the deal. Most of the world's population is growing, and the global economy is creating poor people in far greater numbers than any other type. What you have to ask is the only solution our imagination can come up with for Mexico is to move all the Mexicans here? In the end, if you want a kind of social peace on this planet, you have to find way to share the wealth. And, of course, the most efficient way to share the wealth is where these people already are. In other words, we have to have something the equivalent of a Marshall Plan for a place like Mexico. Otherwise, they're going to keep coming here. Now, the Mexican government, in November of 2001, did a study, and they estimated if their economy operated in the next 30 years at optimum levels, they would export 15 million people to the United States. Of course, if their economy wasn't optimum, they'd export more. That's the reality we're facing now. And I see only one real solution. That's to build up the economy of Mexico some way. Otherwise, they'll keep coming. I defy any of your listeners to go down there, stand in Sonora. I'll give them $20, and they try and make a life. They'd walk across that desert in a minute and come north illegally. But people are not going to die in place. They don't care, you know. Nobody pays attention to the law when they can't even feed their children. They pay attention to taking care of their families.
585-WEST, again, the number 585-9378. Greg, thanks for the call. Brian is with us in Salt Lake. Brian, welcome.
Hi, thank you. And you just kind of touched upon my question. I did want to thank Mr. Bowden for bringing up the fact of, you know, what effect our policies such as NAFTA and CAFTA have on the immigration. I think Americans tend to not pay attention to our economic policies, you know, what they have on other people in the world until it brings negative consequences to us at home. But I wanted to ask Mr. Bowden if he thought there was a way of, you know, reversing those economic policies that might have more beneficial effect than, you know, building walls and passing laws. And
well, personally, I think like NAFTA has to be renegotiated. I mean, NAFTA is a kind of pious fraud, in my opinion. It was, you know, it's a free trade treaty, the silver bullet Americans like. It's the new theology. But it wasn't a free trade treaty. A free trade treaty would be one sentence. There will be no more tariffs. NAFTA is 2,000 pages long. It's got nice little cushy things for everybody except the poor. So what we did was pass a treaty that didn't provide for unions, has no environmental qualifications, and that crushed native industry and native agriculture in Mexico. And then we're supposed to be surprised that suddenly these poor people start streaming toward the United States. It was a very foolish treaty, ill thought by both sides. And frankly, because I think they think free trade is like theology. It doesn't have to be proven. It's just good wherever it is in every form.
585 West, the number, 585-9378. Brian, glad you called. Thanks very much. 585 West. Let's see. Daniel is with us, calling from Salt Lake as well. Daniel, welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, just glad you're on the show talking about, I think, a perspective a lot of people may not think about, because in the political spectrum, whether it's progressive or whether it's conservative, people or the politicians are going to, I think, try and present a view and make laws that may appear to be, you know, pleasing the their constituents, but they're still going to only do things that are going to keep them to continue to get reelected every year, you know. And then as well, I just any law that gets passed, there's always going to be people who slip through those laws, like you were saying before, that like there's a low quota of Mexicans who can come over, there's always going to be more than that quota who want to come. And I think a big part of that is, and I think this is a general overview of the whole world, that where there is not sustainable economy for the common folk, they're going to have to be refugees and go where they can, you know, make money, whether it's immigrating or whatnot, you know, going to Europe and things like that. So, thank you.
Thank you, Daniel.
No, I agree. But as I said, we're an insular nation, historically protected by oceans. And so the consequences of a lot of our policies happen very far away. In the case of Mexico, very far away is the distance of a strand of barbed wire. That's why we're suddenly having to face a reality that's actually global, happening all over the world. And I also agree that the bills in Congress are for domestic consumption. I don't think any of them address the real problem. The president's plan, you know, pathway to citizenship, I mean, you're supposed to go back to Mexico, leave your, you know, your job, everything here, line up, get a permit, come back, and then in 10 or 20 years, if you're a good boy or girl, you get to be a citizen. Well, I don't think very many people are going to think that's a sweet deal that are here. They own homes and they've got families and jobs, and nobody's going to do that. The other bill, the House bills, which are sent basically the welfare program for Halliburton and Boeing, will spend billions building a wall. Well, that's easy. It looks good. See, you can say to your constituents, I'm doing something. All your fat cat friends get the contract. Trust me, there won't be little subcontractors building this wall. And everybody's happy for a while. But none of them address either the migration or what's driving the migration. It will continue, wall or no wall. It'll continue, worker permit or no worker permit. You already know that over 10 million people managed to figure this out without ever getting a permit. So unless you look at the numbers in reality, you're just talking nothing. Now, I can't object to that. I mean, Congress is probably more harmless when it talks nothing, but that's what it's doing.
Charles, I want to have you finally read one more piece. This is from page 50, because I think what the story also gets at is what they want when they come here, because it's complicated. It's this basic biography, as you describe it. They want to go back home, and part of that are these dream houses. Read this section, and I want to have you talk about this, if you will.
Okay. Esperanza waits tables in Los Angeles. At night, she sits and watches a video of her house in Oaxaca. The house has a tile floor, a huge living room. She has never visited this fine residence. Through family, she arranged for the design and construction, and they sent her videos for her pleasure. The building is 5 years old. No one lives in it, and no one may ever live in it. There are similar fine houses popping up in obscure Indian villages across the Mexican South. Their owners cannot afford to visit them because the border crossing has become more difficult and more expensive. But still, they pump money into their dreams and sit in various American cities, staring at screens displaying their distant shelters. The case can be made that it is absurd to build a dream house you can't even visit, much less live in. But that's the nature of dreams. There is always a case to be made against them. This is an exodus. The people coming north are leaving their villages forever, whether they can admit this fact to themselves or not. As long as resources decline and capital flows dislocate traditional economies, as long as overpopulation remains a taboo expression, as long as corrupt governments loot the poor, global trade will produce shockwaves of migrants. It does not matter if the people in the villages or the officials in the various capitals recognize these facts. The forces on the ground will continue to operate as relentlessly as hurricanes gestating in the warming oceans.
And I guess in some ways that's sort of the final thought. I mean, you say that someone asked you, in fact, what should we do? And in fact, it was one of the calls here that we didn't get to, a Patrick in Salt Lake wanting to know, well, what do you do? And this is how you reply in the article. You write, your reply to this person was, you might as well ask me what I think we should do about hurricanes.
Yes. Yeah, he was a redneck guy in South Texas, and he nodded his head. He said, I know what you mean. I've seen guys at work here picked up on Friday and deported, and they're back by Monday. You know, because he was living, you know, within 100 miles of the border, so he had a note of realism. Look, I think there's things we can do, but the first thing we have to do is look at the facts instead of listening to this wind we hear on cable television. These people are not going to destroy our country. You know, it's just a bunch of nonsense that some brown horde of diseased criminals is coming. That's just a lie. They're working people. Now, we got 12 million of them at least here. Unless we want to turn into Nazi Germany, we're never going to be able to deport them. We can't run a healthy country if we have a bunch of people that live here, work, buy houses, pay taxes, etc., and are second-class citizens. We're going to have to bite the bullet on two levels. We're going to have to figure out a decent, humane form of policy toward these illegals here that doesn't violate our sense of self. And we're secondly going to have to do something about illegal immigration, meaning we're going to have to address the things that are displacing these people. And if we don't, we'll continue to have even larger illegal immigration because things are not all happy out there in what we call the third world. I wish some of these guys on cable TV I hear blathering would buy a ticket and go there instead of just this relentless rant.
Charles Bowden, his most recent book is called Inferno. His article, Exodus, Coyotes, Pollos, and the Promised Van, appears in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine. Charles joined us from his home in Tucson. Charles, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Radio West is a production of KEWR News, the program directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.